low-hanging tree branches before we finally emerged into the safety of the driveway.
"Where are we going?"
"You'll see."
I ran up beside him and said, "I don't think my parents are gonna let me watch the show when it's on tonight."
"You probably shouldn't. It's not a show for kids."
"But I'm on it."
"I know you are, Mary. I know it's frustrating, but I can show you some edited parts, the parts with just you and nothing too scary. Is that okay?"
"What's the big deal? It's supposed to be real, right? Just like Finding Bigfoot. It's all about what really happened, and I was there when it happened."
"I don't know quite what to say to that. Yes, you were here when it happened, but you weren't with your sister all the time. You didn't see everything, did you?"
He paused, and I shrugged.
"You should probably talk to your mom and dad about it. It's a scary show. Too intense for you, I think."
We walked across the front lawn to the TV crew's trailer, which was parked half on the street, half on our front yard. Its passenger side tires had sunk partway into the lawn.
"I've told everyone at school, and they're all gonna watch it, so I don't know why I can't watch it too."
Ken didn't say anything to that. He knocked on the trailer door and called out,
"Everyone decent in there?"
Then he whispered down to me,
"Tony will change his clothes right in the middle of the trailer."
"Ew, creepy."
"Totally. So, you wait here. I know he's in there. He might be napping."
Ken disappeared inside. I backed away from the trailer and tried to watch his progress through the trailer windows. I couldn't see him. I did watch the trailer tilt and shift as he walked its length. Ken wasn't gone long and came back out carrying a small black nylon bag. He didn't say anything, just dangled it in front of me and then walked to the front steps. I nipped at his heels.
"Here, let's sit. So we're going to call this the Mary Cam."
He opened the bag and took out a small handheld camera.
"Cool."
I took it and turned it carefully over in my hands. Its metal and plastic was cold and beautiful. It was practically all lens with a small pop-out screen tucked to its side.
"It's yours to use however you want. You can film all you like. You can do your own confessionals whenever and wherever you want. I grabbed this for you, too."
Ken took out a small black notebook wrapped in a red rubber band from his pocket. It looked just like his, but was half the size.
"You can use it to write down a short description of the stuff you filmed that you think is important and could be on the show. When you have good stuff or when you fill up the camera's memory, we can download it, go through your notebook, and decide what we should watch and what we should delete."
Ken showed me how to turn it on, how to delete the file if I didn't want it, how to zoom, how to turn on a small spotlight, and how to charge the battery.
"Just promise you won't go to Barry with your footage. You have to come to me first. Deal?"
"Deal."
We shook on it. Then he said he had to do some work and headed back to the trailer. I ran inside and didn't tell Mom about the camera. I wanted to already have used it, so it would be harder for her to tell me that I couldn't have it. I wonder if Marjorie had her own camera too, and thought about showing her, but decided against it. She might try to take it away and use it for herself. I went up to the confessional room and turned the camera on. I said,
"This is Mary's first video, and I don't need you anymore, confessional room."
Marjorie's bedroom door opened behind me. I turned around and Marjorie was in the hallway, yawning and stretching, hair all over the place, sticking out at odd angles. I pointed the camera at her.
"Marjorie, look what Ken gave to me."
She groaned, blocked her face with one hand, gave me the middle finger with the other. On our premiere night, we had a full house. Barry, Ken, Tony, Jen, a handful of other crew I didn't know by name, a tall man in a jacket and tie, and Father Wanderley as well. Everyone milled about the first floor, eating pizza and drinking out of red cups. Mom and Marjorie were the only ones missing. They were upstairs in Marjorie's room, hiding from all of us. The atmosphere was strange, sort of an almost party. Crew exchanged fist bumps and handshakes when they thought no one was watching. Dad and Father Wanderley gravely thanked each person for their participation, told them they were all doing God's work, reaffirmed that this process was going to help Marjorie get better. Ken kept to himself, appeared to be very nervous, and looked at me like he was wondering if my parents were really going to let me watch the episode. I walked around with my camera filming it all. I caught a snippet of a conversation going on among the tall man in the jacket and tie, Barry, and Father Wanderley. They used words like capital, contributions, and campaign. When Barry saw me, he waved for me to come over to them and introduced me by saying, "This little star is Mary." He never told me the other man's name, or if he did, I no longer remember it. Barry said, "There would be no show without his help, his generous help." The men all laughed, the one in the tie laughing hardest. I didn't like him. He was too tall and stood like he had metal rods inside his back. His brown jacket had dark patches on the elbows. His hair was a weird color, like an almost brown, not a real brown. His skin looked fake, and everything was too close together on his face. He told me I was a special young lady and that he was excited to meet me. I said, "I know. Thanks." The three men laughed like I'd said the funniest joke in the world and then moved me along. So I went around the party stopping the people that I knew for a brief interview in which I asked them a purposefully silly question. I worked my way back to Father Wanderley eventually. He was standing alone next to the dining room table, munching on miniature pretzels. I asked him, "Would you rather have legs the size of fingers or fingers the size of legs?" He said, "I can't say I've ever been asked that before. Both options sound dreadful, don't they?" And then he waved bye to the camera. Marjorie and Mom were still upstairs. Marjorie was always in her room with Mom, Dad, or occasionally Father Wanderley and a camera person. Since my basement confessional, all things Marjorie had been quiet. She ate lunch and dinner with us, went to school some days, and on others she did not. She listened to music a lot. She texted and received texts in random flurries. She occasionally watched TV with us, but mostly she was the ghost of our house, haunting her own bedroom. I began to really believe she was faking and that nothing was wrong with her. Despite my promise to not say anything, I thought about telling Ken what she'd told me. I didn't want to risk doing anything like that right then because I wanted to stay under everyone's radar and somehow manage to watch the show. Right around my usual bedtime, which was 45 minutes before the 10 p.m. premiere of the pilot episode, Mom came downstairs and announced that it was time for me to go to bed. There would be no arguing. The whole downstairs group waved at me and issued a reverent and relieved chorus of, "Good night, Mary." Dad followed me up the stairs, kissed the top of my head, shoved me into the bathroom, and wished me a quick good night before heading back down to the party. In my room, Mom had untied my robe belt from the doorknob and was already sitting on the edge of my bed and fiddling with the alarm clock radio. She tuned it to a station that advertised playing Bedtime Magic. She said, "I'm going to leave the radio on in case things get too loud downstairs." I didn't argue with her. I would just shut the radio off after she left. Instead, I breathed in her face. "Yuck, what are you doing?"
"I just brushed my teeth. Smells good, right?"
"Yes, smells wonderful. Get in bed. Are you going to sleep in your clothes again?"
"Yeah. They're comfy."
I was wearing a long-sleeved Wonder Woman t-shirt and blue sweatpants. I liked sleeping in my clothes in case I had to run out into the hallway at night. I put my pocket notebook, my camera, and my glasses on top of my dresser, and I plugged in the power cord like Ken had shown me. The red light meant it was charging. I placed the camera where I could see it from my bed because I wanted to see when the light would turn to green. I crawled over Mom's lap and under the covers. She playfully smacked my butt.
"Mom!"
"Sorry. It was right there. Hey, did you put that blanket over your house today?"
"Yes,"
I said, and ducked deeper into the covers. Earlier that afternoon, I'd positioned my camera on the bed and had filmed myself throwing an old, thin, blue baby blanket over the top of my house. It was just big enough to cover the windows in the front. We can take the house back downstairs tomorrow if you want. She didn't ask why I'd covered it with a blanket, and she didn't say anything about who or how or why someone had put it back in my room.
Okay.
The overhead light was still on in my room. Mom brushed my bangs off my forehead and had trouble holding my stare. She looked older with her puffy, bloodshot eyes. She gave me an unsure, sad smile. I thought about telling her that her teeth looked really yellow, that she was smoking way too much. I turned over onto my side, away from her, and asked her to rub my back. She rushed through singing a quick song, her go-to song, about falling down an avalanche.
Are you going back to Marjorie's room, or are you going downstairs to watch it?
I'm going to go downstairs, have a glass of wine, or four, and I'm going to watch it. I don't want to, but I think I have to.
I want to watch it.
I know you do, honey. You're being such a good girl with all of this. I love you, and I'm so proud of you. Mom's voice was quiet, quieter than the radio.
Is Marjorie going to watch it?
No, she's not.
Does she want to?
She hasn't asked. I was out of questions, so I closed my eyes. Mom shut off the light, then stayed and rubbed my back for another minute. When I opened my eyes again, she wasn't there anymore, and it was a little after 1 in the morning. I sat up, mad at myself for having missed it all. If nothing else, I'd wanted to try to hear the show, or hear them watching the show. The charging indicator light on the camera was still red. I didn't care. I got up and brought the camera and notebook back to bed with me, shutting off the radio on the way back. I left my glasses on the dresser. Things were fuzzier around the edges, but I could see well enough without them. I sent my ears out as far as I could, but I didn't hear anything happening downstairs. I turned on the camera's LED light and pointed it at the notebook. I reviewed the day's work and decided I could delete the following: my full sprint tour of the house and backyard, the 10 minutes of spy camming who came in and out of the crew's trailer, the 8 minutes of long-distance footage of the Cox kids playing basketball in their driveway, my taping Jen taping me, with her turning away from the camera first and giving me a raspberry, the footage of Marjorie's closed door. I put my notebook under my pillow. I popped out the camera's flip screen, deleted some of the files, and played back the most recent footage of the crew party downstairs. I watched the conversation between Barry, Father Wanderley, and the jacket and tie man. The mic didn't pick up what they'd said, but they clinked their plastic cups together and passed handshakes all around their little circle. Then I watched everyone saying, "Good night, Mary," their collective call crackling in the camera's small speakers, their faces jumpy and blurry as I walked past them. I kept re-watching, and I tried to pick out individual voices to hear who really meant their good night. I may have fallen asleep while watching the video, because what I remember next is the camera resting on my chest, the flip screen dark, but the LED light still on, pointed at my feet. There was a scratching noise coming from my left, from the other side of the room. It wasn't loud, but it was constant, rhythmic. I sat up, hit record, and aimed the camera out across the room like it was a powerful weapon. Its white light diffused through the room along with the scratching noise, which grew louder. The closet door was shut, the blanket on the cardboard house still there, my piles of books and stuffed animals intact. I whispered,
"Marjorie, stop it. Who's there?"
The scratching noise stopped. I thought about running from the room, pictured it in my head, but I saw my feet hitting the floor and then thin, skeleton-white hands reaching out from under my bed and pulling me under. I sat and waited and heard nothing. And the nothing seemed to last for hours. I waited. My camera bleeped at me and I yelped. A red number blinked on the flip screen. I didn't have much battery power left. I watched the blinking red of the screen and then looked over at the blanket-covered house. In the LED white light, the blue blanket looked like it was the same white color as the cardboard house, or the same white the house used to be before its growing things transformation. I stared at or into the blanket, trying to see the blue that I knew was there but wasn't seeing. And then the blanket was sucked inside the house through the shutters of the front window, as though that window was a ravenous black hole. It was pulled in so roughly that the blanket rubbing against the cardboard sounded like the house was being torn open. The chimney piece flew off and landed on the foot of my bed. It all happened so fast, I didn't lose my breath and dropped the camera into my lap until after the blanket had disappeared. I somehow found my voice and said, "I'll scream for Mom. You'll get in big trouble, Marjorie." I pointed the camera back at the house and, feeling more angry than scared, and wanting to ensure Marjorie's torment of me was on video, to have this as a part of the official, permanent record, I added, "This isn't funny." The shutters had rebounded and again covered up most of the window. There weren't any noises coming from inside the house. From the bed, the LED camera light didn't penetrate the small opening between the shutters. I couldn't see Marjorie.
"I'm videoing this, you know."
I waited for a reaction. There wasn't any. So I hit her as hard as I could with,
"I know you're faking. You told me you were faking."
Letting out her biggest secret while recording, I thought for sure that she'd come out of the house, mad at me, telling me that I was a baby and couldn't take a joke, and that she was doing this just to make the show better, and didn't I want to help? And I would say yes, but I'd also cry and make her feel bad so that she'd stay in my room and sleep in my bed. And then we'd delete what I'd recorded, and I would have been happy doing so.
"Marjorie, come on."
I hopped off the bed, looking at what was in front of me through the flip screen of the camera, which was much easier for me than seeing the real thing. I tapped the front door with my foot. Still no reaction. I peeled back one of the shutters and slowly traced the house's interior and floor with the camera's headlight. The crayon drawings on the back wall were crudely drawn cave paintings, and they hung at skewed angles. My blue blanket was in a lumpy heap on the floor. I whispered my sister's name, and when I did, the blanket started to rise slowly. The rising part was long and thin. It was her arm. It had to have been her arm. She was raising it so that it looked like a snake head or a vine. I whispered her name again, and the rising part stopped. The blanket bubbled with activity underneath it, and then the rising part widened, fattened, to the size of her head, a costumed Halloween ghost without the eye holes or mouth hole, as she sat there under the blanket with her legs crossed, or maybe she was crouched, balanced on the balls of her feet, her body concealed by the blanket and by the house's window frame. I told her to get out, to leave my room, to go away. Those skeleton-white hands I'd previously imagined shooting out from under my bed came out from under the blanket and wrapped around her neck. They pulled the blanket down over her face, skin tight, and the blanket formed a shroud with dark valleys for eyes and mouth, her nose flattened against the unyielding cloth. Her mouth moved, and choking growls came out. Those hands squeezed so the blanket pulled tighter, and her blanket-covered mouth opened wider, and she shook her head, thrashing it around violently as she gasped and pleaded with someone to stop, or maybe she said she was trying to stop. Her hands were still closed around her own neck, and I'm sure it was some sort of optical illusion or a trick or a kink of memory because her neck couldn't have gotten as thin as I remember it getting. And then the rest of her body began to spasm and lash out, knocking into the house, her feet jabbing out from underneath and recoiling like a snake's tongue. I took another step back, and suddenly the cardboard house exploded and shot out toward me. The roof smashed into my face and knocked me over. I fell backward, landing hard on my butt and with my back pinned up against my bed. I managed to keep hold of the camera, which, along with my arms and hands, was stuck inside the chimney slot of the house. I couldn't see Marjorie over the house she'd dropped on me, but I heard her run out of my room and into the hallway. I punched and kicked the fallen house, the now loose flaps and folds tangled in my arms and legs like thick weeds. The house finally gave in, slumped off, and rolled away toward the closet. I scrambled to my feet. My blanket was on the ground, in a harmless heap, pinned under the collapsed cardboard. Determined to video in escaping Marjorie, I ran out into the hallway. She wasn't there. The light from my camera failed to reach the end of the hallway and the open mouth of the confessional room. The hallway walls faded and frayed into the dark. I strained to hear movement from Marjorie, from anybody, and all I could hear was my own revved-up breathing. I walked down the hall to her door, the whole time expecting Marjorie to jump out of a darkened corner, the bathroom doorway, the top of the stairs, or from the confessional room. Her door was closed. I tried pushing it open with my foot, but it was latched shut. I turned the knob and threw my body weight into it and stumbled inside. Marjorie was in bed, under the covers, lying on her side, her head turned away from me. I kept the camera's light focused on the back of her head. I whispered her name repeatedly as I walked until I was standing right next to her, the light focused into a tight beam on her profile. Her eyes were closed, and she was breathing deeply and looked to be asleep, and to have been asleep for quite a while. "Marjorie?" I poked her shoulder. No response or movement. I watched her on the flip screen. The covers slowly rose and fell with each breath, and her face looked green. I kept the camera light on but paused the recording with a small electronic blip. Marjorie opened an eye and rolled it back toward me. She said, "Did you get it all?" in a low, creaky voice. She calmly repeated herself when I didn't respond initially.
"Yeah? Good girl. Show it to your pal Ken tomorrow after school. Go back to bed."
I was suddenly exhausted and could have curled up and gone to sleep right there on her floor. I shuffled out of her room and into the hallway. I looked back and Marjorie was sitting up, muttering to herself and plugging earbuds into her phone, the music already on and loud, something with heavy, rhythmic synthesizers. Marjorie snuggled back into bed and whispered, "Shut the door, Mary." But I didn't. Out in the hallway, I found Tony, the cameraman, easing his way up the stairs, night vision camera perched on his shoulder. He didn't appear to be in any giant rush to get all the way up here. He sounded annoyed when he said,
"What's going on, Mary? Did I miss something?"
I said, "No, nothing." He asked me something else, but I turned and walked across the hall into my parents' bedroom. I shut the door quietly behind me and on Tony, who was now at the top of the stairs, filming me. I'd felt the camera pointed at my back. I stood behind the door and listened to him creep a little farther down the hallway and pause at Marjorie's door. Her door creaked and then latched, and Tony walked back downstairs, the wood groaning under his giant, sloppy feet. I put my camera down on the cluttered nightstand next to Mom's head. I crawled over her and into the bed, easily fitting myself between my parents, who slept as far away from each other as they could. The next morning I wore my best dress, because it was what someone who was on a TV show was supposed to wear. It was dark maroon, squared at the shoulders, and short-sleeved, so I wore a white cardigan over it. Mom had bragged about buying it for only $10. She tried to talk me out of wearing the dress to school. It wasn't warm enough, I'd get it dirty at recess or lunch or art class, but I wouldn't budge. I couldn't wait to ask my friends and classmates if they'd seen me on TV last night. I figured that at least some of my friends might have been able to fool their parents into letting them watch it because they wouldn't have known what it was about or what was on it. Dad offered to drive me to school, but Mom said she would, and then she was going to run some errands. Plus, she wanted him to wake up Marjorie and ask her if she was going to school or Dr. Hamilton today. She had to choose one to go to. She couldn't stay home. A brief, controlled argument ensued. With cameras and crew members watching, my parents had to keep their dramas quick and to the point. I didn't wait for its rushed and hushed conclusion. I sprinted out the door ahead of Mom, who yelled after me to wait for her. I didn't wait. I ran to our car parked in the driveway and started yanking on the locked back door.
"Mom, it's locked. Come on."
As I walked around the car to try the doors on the other side, I noticed there was a small group, maybe 5 people, holding handwritten signs in the street near our front lawn. Barry was talking to them. I couldn't hear him, but he didn't seem happy. Mom said, "I told you to wait for me." She unlocked the doors. I asked her who those people were. She sighed and said, "I don't know, but they better not be here when I get back." I ducked down in my seat as we drove by them, resting my face at the bottom of the window frame so they'd only see the top of my head and my glasses peering out. An old man pointed at us as we drove by and held up his sign, but it was spun around backward, and by the time he flipped it around, we were too far away to read it. At school, when I breathlessly asked my friends if they'd seen the show, most said they weren't allowed to watch because it was an adult show and/or it was on so late. A few said they'd seen commercials and it looked creepy. Samantha asked why I wore a fancy dress to school. Kara said that she saw some of it but didn't see me in the parts that she watched, but then it was too scary to keep watching. Brian said the show was gross. At recess and lunch, a pack of 4th and 5th graders, including the neighbor that Marjorie had punched in the face on my behalf a few years ago, made fun of me and Marjorie and called my whole family a bunch of freaks. I immediately told on them. I was more upset that, of my friends, only Kara and Brian had seen it, and they didn't have anything good to say about it. I asked teachers, too, and my favorite, Mrs. Newcomb, said, politely, that she hadn't seen the show, that, "I don't watch much TV, I'm afraid. I'm just too busy planning for our school day." When I got home, there were more people standing out front holding signs. They stood behind yellow police tape. Mom said, "We may have to get used to this for a little while," then went on to say that they were religious fanatics who didn't approve of what we were doing, and there was nothing we could do about them as long as they stayed off our property. Dad had apparently tried to intimidate them away from our house, and he even made physical contact with a few of the protesters, grabbing them by the arm and pulling them down the street. Father Wanderley had intervened and calmed Dad down. Father Wanderley was still out there talking to a few of them. Even though it was cold out, his forehead looked sweaty. They waved their signs at us as we pulled into the driveway. Some signs had names and numbers on them, which I found out later were references to Bible verses. 2 signs had red block letters. One sign read, "Judgment is coming." Another, "Don't profit off the devil's work." Although this new development was interesting, I decided it wasn't my problem and didn't involve me, at least not yet. I ran into the house and changed back into my sweats and Wonder Woman t-shirt. Then Ken and I and my camera went into the cruise trailer. There was a little living room section toward the front with a mini kitchen and couch, but the rest of it was monitors, equipment, and black chairs with wheels. He hooked up my camera to his laptop, which he'd synced to one of the large wall monitors, and we watched the previous night's footage. We heard the scratching noise. We listened to me announce to the cardboard house that I knew she was faking. We saw the blanket disappear. Ken jumped in his chair and grabbed my arm when it happened. We saw the blanket rise inside the house and the skeleton hands wrap around her neck. The hands didn't look as long and as thin as they had when it was really happening. We watched the house fly into the camera. We saw the lens pressed up against a drawing of Marjorie's face, her mouth a big red O, while I grunted and struggled to get the house off me. We watched as the camera bobbed down the hall and into Marjorie's room, where she appeared to be asleep, and I couldn't wake her up. When it ended, Ken said,
"Wow. Are you okay, Mary?"
"I'm okay. It didn't look as scary as I remember it."
"I bet. But still, watching it was... that was really scary."
"Is this something you can use?"
"Yes, most definitely. But really, are you okay?"
"Yeah, just a bad day at school." Then I told him about my friends and Mrs. Newcomb for not watching or liking the show, and how the older kids made fun of me. Ken said,
"I'm sorry, Mary, but as I'm sure your parents have told you, that kind of stuff is probably going to get worse as more episodes air. I think this year at school will be really hard, and it's certainly not fair to you, not at all. What we're doing here will be hard for people to understand.
I know. I'll be okay. I'm tough.
Yeah, you are. You're the toughest person I know. Just make sure you talk to your parents or to someone at school, or me if you want, when it gets too hard, okay?
I will.
I didn't want to talk about school anymore. I asked,
will you change things?
What do you mean?
I didn't want to come right out and ask if he was going to cut out the part about me saying that Marjorie was faking. The video I made, will you change it?
You mean, will I edit it?
Yeah.
We always do some editing. Sometimes we really cut it up and move around the different scenes if we think it'll work better that way. Sometimes we just do small cuts or tweaks, add some sound or music or voiceover narration. But just seeing it once, I don't think we'll change much of what you filmed at all.
I nodded and was worried that he didn't really pick up on me talking about Marjorie faking everything while we watched it, but he surely would later when he showed it to Barry. I didn't want to be there for that, so I said, okay, bye, and darted quickly for the door.
Wait, don't forget to take your camera back.
Ken held it up and out toward me, and he shrugged, like he knew I wasn't sure I wanted the camera back. Or maybe he wasn't sure he should give the camera back to me. I actually didn't want it, but I wanted Ken to go on thinking that I was still tough. So I took the camera. I went inside and up to my room. I put it in the top drawer of my dresser, layered some t-shirts on top of it, and decided I wouldn't use it again. Chapter 18. The morning after the second episode aired, I told Mom that I wasn't feeling well and wanted to stay home from school. I told her my stomach hurt and I thought I had a fever when I didn't. I felt fine. She placed the back of her hand on my forehead, and that was enough. She didn't question me further or take my temperature. Marjorie stayed home from school, too. She hadn't been to school in a week since the first episode aired. After spending a long, boring morning in my room rereading the old stories Marjorie and I had written in the Richard Scarry book and counting how many cats she'd drawn glasses on and had named Mary, there were 54. I still remember that number. I came downstairs around lunchtime and announced that I was feeling better. I was dressed up as a news reporter, black t-shirt, black tights, a straw fedora, one blue sock and one red sock, both knee-length. The red sock was a regular sock. The blue sock was one of those glove socks that had toes and made my foot look like it was a Muppet foot. A button-up red-knit sweater jacket that hung down almost to my knees. The sweater jacket had deep front pockets in which I stashed my reporter's pencil and the black notebook that Ken had given me. There wasn't any crew on the first floor, but I took notes anyway as I worked my way to the kitchen. Dad was hunched over the sink and washing dishes by hand. I wrote down, dishes. Dirty.
Hi, sweetie. Feeling better, I take it?
I asked. Yes. How come you're not using the dishwasher?
There weren't that many dishes to wash.
I pursed my lips and nodded. On to the next question. Where's Mom?
Out with Marjorie.
I wrote that down, too, and underlined it.
But she'll be back soon. We have a big meeting and...
He looked over at the oven clock.
Geez, less than an hour.
Can I be there for the meeting? I'm a reporter, see? I'll take notes.
No, I don't think so. But we may have something to talk to you about afterward.
What? Tell me. I had my pencil pressed into the notebook.
You're too funny. But I can't tell you. Mom and I and everyone else have to discuss it first. It's nothing bad, though, I promise.
But I'm a reporter, so you have to tell me.
Sorry to be a tease, but we'll talk after, okay?
Ugh, I can't wait until after.
Dad laughed, and despite 2,000 volts of frustration tingling and twitching through my body, I laughed too. Everything about him that morning seemed relaxed and brighter than it had in months. He'd always been a moody guy. No one was funnier or more fun to play with than he was when in the right mood, and you could feel the barometric pressure drop when he wasn't.
I heard the front door open and hoped that the big meeting was about to happen and that since I was there already, they'd let me watch and take notes. But it was only Jen. She walked into the kitchen without announcing herself. Someone in the trailer must have seen me and Dad together on the surveillance cams, so she was dispatched in case our interaction was video-worthy.
Are you sure I can't be at the big meeting?
I looked at Jen in the camera when I said it, even though I was talking to Dad.
Yes, I'm sure. What do you want for lunch, kid?
I said,
mac and cheese?
Like I was asking if I could get away with something big. Mom would have said no and that I had to stick to the brat diet because of my stomach issues, which I seemed to have a lot of at that age, and then made me a plain piece of toast.
Your stomach doesn't hurt anymore?
Nope.
Did it really hurt at all this morning?
A little.
I stuck my face into the open notebook.
Do you think it'll hurt tomorrow morning?
I don't think so.
Okay, good. Maybe I'll have some too. Take down some notes while I make it.
He boiled water and pretended to be a scientific expert on the properties of water boiling and how long it needed to boil to make the perfect batch of mac and cheese. I wrote it all down and asked him the tough questions. He spoke of the golden ratio of cheese dust to milk and butter, the diameter and girth of the elbow-shaped pasta, the conductive properties and molecular structure of the white froth that bubbled over the pot. He held up the blue and yellow box and described the superhuman nutritional benefits of each ingredient. He used a funny scientist's accent. When it was ready, we evenly distributed the pasta into two bowls and tested the cheese sauce's tensile strength, which bowl could keep a fork standing vertically the longest. My bowl won. We laughed, ate, and had a good time. I remember this lunch in great detail because I remember it as being the last time he was happy Dad with me. That might sound maudlin, sentimental, and hyperbolic, but that doesn't mean it isn't true. Mom turned up the TV's volume purposefully loud and took the remote control with her into the kitchen. I sat in the living room only sort of watching an episode of Teen Titans. My parents, Father Wanderley, Barry, and Ken were in the kitchen having their big meeting. Because of what Dad had said earlier, I knew I was the subject. After the months of all things for Marjorie, I was pleased that something happening in this house potentially involved me. With Marjorie almost exclusively sucking up all our parental resources, I'd felt like I was getting lost, a loose picture that had fallen out of the family album. I couldn't hear anything said in the meeting, and the one time I tried to sneak across the room and get closer to the kitchen, Dad heard and sternly ordered me back to my spot on the couch. The meeting lasted forever, and I began to hate the Teen Titans, particularly Beast Boy and his snaggletooth. But finally, everyone came into the living room. Mom sat next to me on the couch. She still had the remote and shut off the TV, and then she rubbed my back in slow circles, which made me nervous. It was an obvious sign we were to discuss something serious. Barry stood near the front door and spoke quietly into his Bluetooth. Jen and Tony and their cameras emerged shortly thereafter, each flanking one end of the room. Ken sat in the plush chair by the front windows, lost in his notebook. I waved at him, but he didn't see me. Both Ken and Barry stood outside of camera range, so they presumably wouldn't be in the shot. Dad followed Father Wanderley into the room and carried one of the kitchen chairs, which he set directly in front of the TV. Dad sat there and struggled to get comfortable. Father Wanderley had a red, leather-bound book tucked under his left arm. He said,
"Hello, Mary. I love your red jacket. Looks cozy."
He always sounded like his words were full of helium, which rose and dangled above your head. He methodically worked his way around the coffee table to sit on the couch next to me. I scooted away, closer to Mom, and I stuffed my hands into the jacket pockets.
"Hello. It's not cozy. I'm wearing it because I'm a reporter," I said, and looked nervously at Dad.
I was afraid that if I didn't address Father Wanderley like he wanted me to, he'd get angry. Dad gave me a reassuring nod and said,
We're going to talk more about what it is Father Wanderley is trying to do to help Marjorie, and how he thinks you can help him. Okay?
I was disappointed at first to hear this was still about Marjorie, but that quickly passed with the realization that these adults, their actions and motives as mysterious as ever, were going to tell me more, and they wanted my help. Father Wanderley said, "That's right, Mary. Are you feeling better? I'm told you stayed home from school today."
"I'm better. I think I was just really hungry and that made my stomach hurt."
"I understand."
He smiled and showed off his big teeth, which were a dingy shade of gray. Up this close to him, I could see flurries of dandruff sprinkled on his shoulders. The white collar squeezed his Adam's apple so tightly a small flap of skin folded over it. His face was thick with beard stubble that went higher on his cheeks than it should have, and I thought about making a werewolf joke. His blue eyes were so light I was afraid if I looked too hard and long I could see straight through into the back of his head. He smelled like powder.
"I'm going to take notes, okay?"
I took the notebook and pencil out of my pockets.
"Of course."
He leaned in closer to me and asked,
"Do you know why I'm here?"
I nodded, even though I was still fuzzy on how he was going to help us.
"You know that I'm here to help your sister and your family and you."
I nodded again, impatient for him to get to the part where he described how I'd be helping, annoyed that he was talking to me as though I were 4, not 8.
"I've watched the video you shot in your room, Mary, and I've watched your interviews, including that, what do you call it, Barry, a confessional? I'm not sure I approve of that."
Father Wanderley smiled at Barry, who returned a who-me shrug.
"In one of them, you said an evil spirit lived inside Marjorie. Did she tell you that?"
"Yeah, in the basement, she said it to me. Yeah."
"Well, Mary, my first job here is to figure out if she really has a demon spirit inside her."
"Well, it's what she told me?"
I started looking to Mom and Dad in a panic, thinking that he somehow knew that what I'd told everyone had happened in the basement was a lie. Father Wanderley said,
"Mary, I believe you, and I believe that, unfortunately, your poor sister is possessed. I believe that somehow a demon spirit has gotten inside her, and it's what makes her act so strangely, so not like your sister used to be. Yes? My second job, by the Lord's infinite grace, power, and love, is to help her and your family by getting the demon out of Marjorie, so it'll go away and leave her alone forever."
"How?"
"I'll perform the sacramental ritual of exorcism."
He patted the leather book that was now resting in his lap. I was getting more nervous, so I drew a chain of circles in my notebook. Dad said,
"Mary, stop doodling and pay attention."
Mom said, "John, she's doing fine." She squeezed my shoulders, and it turned one of my circles into a squashed blob. Ken looked up from his notebook, but not at me. Dad crossed his arms over his chest and did that thing where he jutted out his bottom jaw and released air through the side of his mouth. I asked Father Wanderley,
"Are you going to read that to her?"
And pointed at his small, red leather-bound book.
"More or less, yes, I will read and pray, which is all part of performing the rite of exorcism."
"Have you tried it yet?"
"We have not tried it yet. Performing an exorcism is very serious business, the most serious. I first need to get the permission of our local bishop. In order to do so, we must make sure that there is a demon inside Marjorie, and that she's not simply, how should I put it, that she's not just sick."
"Oh, so if she's only sick, you can't help her, and we just have to give her medicine or something, and then she'll be better again?"
"Well, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ can and does always help, but I'm afraid it's not that simple."
Dad cut in with,
"We're all tired, scared, and confused as to why this is happening to Marjorie and to us. But everyone in this house is confident that Marjorie is possessed by a demon.
That's how they say it, Mary. Possessed. Okay? Otherwise, we wouldn't have gone to the lengths that we've gone to here. What Father Wanderley is saying is that the church has to be absolutely sure before he can help her and read the special prayers from his book.
I think you should just read the special prayers to her now anyway, just in case.
I leaned back into Mom, looked up at her, and said,
Mom?
I didn't say, do you believe there's an evil spirit inside Marjorie, too? But that was what I meant. She said, remember all of Marjorie's doctor's appointments? We've been trying medicine, and we've been trying everything we can think of, and things with her are still getting worse. So we're doing what we think is best. Father Wanderley truly wants to help your sister. No one else said anything right away. Dad leaned back in his chair. The wood creaked and groaned. I wrote the word chair down in my notebook and drew a picture of one that had a long back and short legs, and then I quickly drew a ghost that haunted it. Father Wanderley said, Mary, this afternoon, Dr. Navidson, who I've been consulting with, is coming over to finish his evaluation, or his, checkup of Marjorie on behalf of the church.
Who's that? I thought her doctor was Dr. Hamilton, right, Mom?
Mom said, Dr. Hamilton is still her doctor, sweetie. This new doctor is helping out Father Wanderley.
Why does she need another doctor?
Father Wanderley said, Dr. Hamilton is a very good man and doctor, but being an atheist, he does not have the sense of spiritual reality required for Marjorie's case.
What's an atheist?
I drew another ghost. Father Wanderley leaned down to get into my field of vision. When I looked up at him, he said,
A non-believer, someone who doesn't believe in Jesus or God.
Mom said, An atheist doesn't believe there are any gods, Mary. I wasn't sure what I was. I thought about asking if there was a name for that, a name for me, but I just said,
Okay.
Father Wanderley said, Dr. Navidson is both a man of science and a good Christian.
Our Bishop Ford recommended him highly. He has seen all the videos and read your interviews, and he's coming over today to talk with Marjorie in person. I'm going to be in the room. Your parents will be there, and I'd like to ask if you would consider joining us as well, because we need your help.
I sat up, scooted toward the edge of the couch, and looked at both of my parents, trying not to seem too excited. Mom said,
You don't have to if you don't want to.
Dad didn't say anything.
I want to. I want to help. What do I get to do?
I wondered if I was going to have to dress up in a black shirt with buttons. I didn't like black shirts, and I didn't like shirts with buttons. And wear a white collar and say some of the words in the book Father Wanderley had on his lap. I couldn't read the cover. It was in a different language that almost looked like English, but wasn't. Father Wanderley said,
For now, just your being there in the room is the help we need, Mary.
How will that help anything? I want to do something. I can read stuff. I can use my camera.
I tried to get Ken to look at me, but he was hidden behind Tony, the cameraman, who had left the periphery and now stood only a few feet away from the couch. Father Wanderley said,
We've all noticed that the spirit inside Marjorie manifests or reacts strongest when you are in the same room as Marjorie, and on more than one occasion, the spirit has taken her to your room as though seeking you out to be its audience. Please let me be clear. I'm not saying that you are the cause of her affliction, or that what she does is in any way your fault, Mary, because it's not. Not at all. But we do think the demonic spirit is attracted to you because it shows itself primarily when you are around. So by being in Marjorie's room today during Dr. Navidson's visit, we'll increase the chances that he'll witness a manifestation event.
A what?
He'll see something that Marjorie does and will then know that she has a demon inside her. And then he'll be able to report to the bishop that poor Marjorie is truly suffering at the hands of an evil entity.
Okay.
I put my notebook back in my pocket and I leaned against Mom's chest again. I felt cold all of a sudden and thought I might start shaking for the rest of my life. Mom hugged me and said, "I'm going to be with you, and if it gets to be too scary or too much, we can leave whenever you want. I promise." Dad said in a low voice,
"I'll be in there with you too."
I didn't ask for further explanation, but Father Wanderley kept going and said,
"If the visit goes like I think it will go, we can petition Bishop Ford for permission to perform the exorcism. I would then prepare myself over the course of the following week, fasting, praying, making confession, not in the room upstairs, of course, but in a church, and say a mass for Marjorie and ask for God's help.
Then?
Then you will all help me perform the rite of exorcism, and we will expel the evil from Marjorie."
"What if it doesn't work?"
"We'll perform the rite again, as many times as is necessary."
"Is that other doctor coming over soon?"
Mom said, "Later tonight. But everyone, hold on a second. Mary, sweetie, look at me. It's going to be hard. It's probably going to be scary. We don't really know what she might say or do."
Dad said, "You mean we don't know what the demon might say or do, right?"
Mom said, "Yeah, right. So are you sure about all of this, Mary?"
"I'm sure," I said, but I wasn't sure at all. I didn't know what a rite of exorcism was. I didn't even know how to pray, really, or I didn't know any prayers anyway. And what if Marjorie did something so bad to me in front of everyone that would make me upset and blurt out that she was faking, that all of it was a fake? But what if she wasn't faking, and it was some evil spirit inside her that told me she was faking? I didn't know what to think, and just started talking, even though Dad and Father Wanderley had already stood up and drifted over toward Barry. "Yeah, I'm sure I can help. I'm not scared. I'm tough. Ken said I was tough when we were playing soccer, so I know I can do it."
Ken smiled, closed his notebook, gave me a little wave with his hand, and then left the room and the house. When he opened the front door, the front foyer filled with light. Father Wanderley said,
"You're a very brave, remarkable little girl, Mary. I bet you give all the boys trouble on the playground."
"I don't give anybody trouble."
Mom said, "Why don't you go out back and kick the soccer ball around? I'll come out there with you in a few minutes, okay?" When I was outside waiting for Mom and kicking the ball as hard as I could into the net, I wasn't thinking about being in Marjorie's room with everyone else, including the new doctor. Instead, I obsessed over Father Wanderley's trouble comment. I imagined being at a playground and handing out little black bags to all the kids, not just the boys. They opened them and found little hard candies inside, each poisoned with trouble.
Chapter 19. Dr. Navidson came to our house shortly after we finished eating dinner. When the doorbell rang, Mom was upstairs in the confessional room with a glass of wine. Dad was in the kitchen being asked on camera to talk about what he was thinking and feeling before the arrival of Dr. Navidson, and I was sitting on the living room floor doing my math homework, but listening to Dad. Ken and Father Wanderley were in the living room, too. Ken lost in his black notebook, Father Wanderley lost in his special red leather book. I ran to the door and Dad called out from the kitchen, telling me to wait for him. I didn't wait for him. I threw open the door and nearly shouted,
"Hello, Dr. Navidson."
He said, "Hello," back and sidestepped around me and into the house, careful not to make any accidental contact. Dad rushed up from behind and practically pushed me away and onto the steps. Dr. Navidson was shorter than the other men, had light brown hair and a thick, woolly beard, the kind that had to have taken years to grow. I hadn't seen any foxes in real life, but I imagined his beard and hair had the same consistency as a fox. He was younger than I expected and wore glasses with thin silver frames that boxed in his nervous eyes. He wore a black sweater and jeans,
black shoes that had thick rubber soles, and he carried a laptop that was as thin as my Richard Scarry book. There wasn't a lot of standing around and chit-chat like normally there would be for a new guest in the house. He politely shook hands with my parents and declined Mom's offer of a glass of water while Dad herded him into the living room. He and Father Wanderley greeted by using first names and briefly embracing. Dad was agitated and paced the living room, running a hand through his hair.
"I'm sure Dr. Navidson is a very busy man. We should probably head upstairs as soon as possible."
Father Wanderley put a hand on Dad's shoulder, which stopped the pacing, and said,
"Yes, of course, John. I know you're anxious. We're all anxious."
Then he insisted that we join hands and pray before going upstairs to Marjorie's room. I went and stood next to Mom, who put her hands on my shoulders. I motioned for her to come down to my level so I could whisper into her ear.
"I don't know how to pray."
She whispered down to me and breathed on my face. I covered my nose.
"It's okay. Just bow your head and think good thoughts for Marjorie, and if you want to, ask God for help."
The three men held hands. Dad held out a hand to Mom or me. Mom took it, and then she took my hand. Father Wanderley said a prayer asking for God's love and strength in the face of the evil we might encounter. Dr. Navidson's eyes were closed so tightly, it was as though he was afraid to open them. Father Wanderley said,
"Lord, hear our prayer,"
which was echoed by Dad and Dr. Navidson. Then he started another prayer that began with,
"Our Father, who art in heaven,"
and everyone joined in, even Mom. I moved my mouth, pretending that I knew the words too. When we finished, Father Wanderley walked over to me and said,
"Do not be afraid, Mary. Anyone who believes in our Lord Jesus Christ has nothing to fear."
Mom bent down and whispered to me again before Father Wanderley had stopped talking.
"Don't worry. I'll be up there with you, and we can leave whenever you want, okay?"
Barry jogged downstairs and asked that we give him one more minute for them to set up the shot and the lighting in the hallway and in Marjorie's room. He clapped his hands together, and no one said anything. Dad started pacing again. Mom finished her wine and left the glass on the coffee table. After getting the okay from Barry, us Barretts led the way upstairs. Dad went first, with Mom and I right behind him. The rest of our wagon train followed, Father Wanderley, Dr. Navidson, and Tony, the cameraman. Jen was already at the top of the stairs, following our expedition's progress. The second-floor hallway was warm and brightly lit. The ceiling fixtures had been scrubbed clean, and the yellowish bulbs replaced with bright white ones. The two spotlights from inside the confessional sunroom were pointed out into the hallway, flooding the second floor with their wattage. I could feel their heat on the back of my neck. Marjorie's door was shut, but the doors to the bathroom and the other bedrooms were open. In those other rooms, the lights were off, and each doorway was a dark mouth. Mom and I were jostled by the others jockeying for position in front of Marjorie's door. Dad knocked lightly and said,
"Honey, we're here. We just want you to meet with Dr. Navidson and Father Wanderley for a few minutes like we talked about."
There was no response from Marjorie. Dad turned the knob and slowly opened the door as he said,
"They're going to ask you a few questions."
Dad walked in first, followed by the men. I was the last one in, shuffling behind Mom. Jen stayed in the doorway, effectively blocking off my promised escape route. I felt tricked and trapped initially, but decided I'd be able to dash under and between her legs in an emergency. It was always smart to have a plan. Marjorie's desk lamp was the only light on in the room. Everything looked clean and tidy. Her posters were gone. Her bureau top was visible, and her closed laptop sat by itself on her desk. The stuffed animals and knick-knacks had been taken away. The wall she'd kicked and punched holes into had been replastered but not painted.
Father Wanderley said, "Hello, Marjorie. This is Dr. Navidson."
The two men sat in skeleton-thin wooden chairs that I had never seen before. The chairs flanked her bed. The built-in lights on the two cameras focused on Marjorie, leaving the two men in shadow. She sat up with her back against the windowsill, legs hidden under the blankets. Her earbuds